This segment of Perspectives originally aired in April of 2011.
You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Bob Mihalov. Bob is on the board of directors of the Children's Grief Center of El Paso. Bob, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thanks for having me, Louis.
Now tell us a little bit about the Children's Grief Center of El Paso, because a lot of times when we think of grief and centers, we think of the adults. We think about, family members, the older members, but a lot of times we forget about the children.
Absolutely. And I believe that that's the unique aspect that this particular organization has to offer. We are the only bereavement center in the El Paso area that specifically focuses on helping children deal with the loss of a family member or loss of a loved one. I first came across the center back in late 2004 when my first wife, Claudia, died of breast cancer, and I was left with three kids to raise. And I was referred to the grief center by one of the hospice organizations, and I spent a year and a half taking my children there to help them deal with the loss of their mom, and at the same time, for me to learn to deal with the loss of my wife and to help my kids go through the grieving process.
Now, was it hard at first when they recommended that to you? Because perhaps, and sometimes I'm speaking as a man, sometimes we as men, we feel like, well, we can do it. I can do this on my own. Nobody needs to tell me, how to console my children, et cetera.
Absolutely. You're right. As men, we tend to think of our ability to deal with things ourselves and solve problems. Unfortunately, one of the realities that I experienced when I lost my wife to cancer was that I couldn't do it all by myself. And so I realized pretty quickly that I needed help. And that's why I was willing to take my kids there.
Now, if you don't mind me saying, your children were rarely small, especially the two youngest ones. And I'm sure that, and I'm just guessing, that perhaps the hardest one to deal with was the young man.
Well, I think each child handled it differently. Certainly, my son had different issues to deal with than my two daughters did, part of it being the middle child, and just different relationships that they each had with their mom. But I think that the way the organization is structured and the way they facilitate the sessions with the children, it doesn't really matter what age they are. They facilitate based on the age of the kids. They break the children into age-appropriate groups. So, for example, my youngest one, who I believe was 10 at the time, was with other kids in the 9 to 10-year-old range. My 13-year-old son was with 13 and 14-year-olds and so forth. So the facilitation is based on the age of the kids.
A lot of times children tend to blame themselves for the death of a parent. If I had only done this, or if I had been better, maybe this wouldn't have happened.
I think it's inevitable that somebody's going to that the children and the parents are going to deal with that. I certainly went through that myself. I wondered what I could have done differently to avoid my wife and her death. But the reality is, it's not the kid's fault. It's not the parent's fault. And so that is certainly one of the things that the center focuses on, is helping the kids come to grips with the fact that it wasn't their fault that their loved one died. But the important thing is to be able to express what they're feeling and get them talking about it. Once they talk about it and they hear other children talking about it as well, they realize they're not alone. And the emotions that they're going through, the challenges that they're facing, whether it's at school or at home dealing with family members, they're not going through it by themselves. They're not the only one dealing with it.
And what about getting them there, Bob?
I won't lie. It was a challenge. Different times, different children didn't necessarily want to go. But there's a lot of times as parents that we have to make the decision to do things with our children, to force them to do things, even though they may not want to do that. To do it that we know are in their best interest. And so that was my perspective. I took my kids there, whether they really wanted to go or not, because I knew ultimately they would benefit from it.
A lot of times when something like this happens, someone will come up to you and inevitably will say, I'm sorry, I know how you feel, but they don't know how you feel. And so when the children go to the grief center, how do these people handle the children, because they can't say, I know how you feel. I mean, some of them, I'm sure, say, I've lost a parent when I was young, too, et cetera, so I kind of know how you feel. But how do they work with the children?
Well, I think that's the beauty of the way the organization operates the sessions. Again, they break the kids into age-appropriate groups, and then they have the parents all meet together in one group as well. It's very much a parent and children-focused organization. You have to have children to be able to go there as a parent, and the children can't go there by themselves. But in the facilitation process, it's not about the facilitator trying to provide compassion. I mean, they're compassionate, but they're not trying to offer the counseling as much as they're trying to get the kids to relate to the other kids and see that, again, they're not the only ones dealing with this kind of problem. And when some of the other children start talking and expressing some of their emotions, some of the challenges that they're facing, then the facilitator can basically get the kids talking amongst each other and help getting them to help each other understand how to best deal with it.
Sometimes it depends on the culture also, and everybody has a different way of grieving. And I remember, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, there's a book called On Death and Dying, and it's offered to social workers, to social work classes. And I went to a conference, and they offered this book. But they showed a film showing social workers that you have to deal with people differently because everyone's different, and everybody has a different way of grieving. Some will not say anything. Some will stay quiet for a year. Some can't cry. Some will be crying all the time. And you can't say, stop it, get over it. It's over now.
That's right. Everybody deals with it differently. My three children dealt with their grieving process differently, and I dealt with it differently than they did. The facilitators at the grief center don't try to put them into a box. They don't try to get them all to behave the same way. All they're really trying to do is help them through the process, help them to express their emotions, help them to understand that it is okay to grieve. You're absolutely right. There's a lot of times where children that go to the center for the counseling may not say anything for weeks, but it doesn't mean that they're not listening to the other children. It doesn't mean that they're not starting to come to grips with the emotions that they're feeling. And in their time, they will start to express what they're feeling.
Another thing that may happen, and I don't want to say this to be mean, but it's reality. Sometimes children can be very cruel, and when they go to school, they get made fun of. Your mom died because of this, your dad died, and it's very hard on the child.
It is. The reality is that we serve families from all types of death, whether it's a health issue like cancer or a heart attack, tragic accidents that happen, murder, suicide, whatever it is. And so each child is coming from a different perspective. But one of the common things is that you're absolutely right, that kids can be cruel. And one of the common situations that happens when kids lose a loved one is that they start to suffer at school. Lowering grades, dropping grades is a very, very common situation with kids that are grieving. And so part of the process is helping them understand how to deal with the way other kids talk to them and recognize that it's not personal. It's just the way kids are, and that they need to become comfortable at going through the grieving process regardless of what other people are saying to them.
Unfortunately, all these services, all these meetings, all this help costs money. And I would suspect that you all are a nonprofit group.
Absolutely. To start with, yes, we are a nonprofit, but we also recognize that in the private sector, this type of counseling, this type of help can be very cost prohibitive for families when you're taking multiple people that are trying to deal with the loss of a family member. We charge a very nominal fee for our services. It's only $40 for the initial consultation and then $25 per family per meeting. And that's regardless of how many children that you're bringing there. We try to make it very affordable. But the reality is we are a nonprofit. And so we do rely on other sources of revenue to try to stay open and be able to provide the service that we do.
So it all stays here in El Paso.
Absolutely. And quite honestly, we get families that will drive in from as far as Alamogordo, I think even Truth or Consequences. We have people that drive in from an hour, 2 hours away every other week to be able to attend these sessions because we're the only children's bereavement center in West Texas. I mean, there's nobody even close to us.
It's no secret what's happening across the border with the terrible violence that's going on. Have you received clients, children who have lost parents to this violence?
Yes, we have. Obviously, we have to be pretty everything that happens there is confidential. In fact, even the conversations that take place in the small groups with the children, we as parents don't hear back what specific children said about specific things. The Laura Olage, who's the executive director, facilitates the discussion with the parents. And so she'll weave in topics that the children are dealing with into the discussions that she has with the parents. But never will there be a specific child's comment brought up because it's all confidential and we want the kids to feel safe in that environment. And quite honestly, specifically when you're dealing with somebody who's had a family member murdered because of the violence that's going on across the border, and we have families that come across, they're already very scared about somebody finding out about them. And so it's that much more important that we ensure the children that their conversations are confidential, that nobody's going to find out about what they have to say.
A lot of times when you have a nonprofit group, the people who may want to use your services will sometimes wonder, well, the people who are going to be listening to my children or who are going to be taking care of my children, are they professional? What kind of background do they have?
Most of them come out of some level of education in the social services, counseling type of field. But before they're allowed to actually work as a facilitator in the sessions, and all of them are volunteers, by the way. All of the facilitators are volunteers. Before they can do that, they go through a series of training sessions that are led by Laura Olage, who's a certified professional in this field. So they have the training, and then generally they'll work with another more experienced facilitator before they're allowed to actually lead a group on their own.
Now, obviously, I mean, you obviously had a very good experience, or else you wouldn't have been on the board of directors.
Absolutely. One of the things that I learned quickly when I started attending the center myself was that I'm not the only one going through it. In fact, I can remember the very first meeting I went to, there were three other men who, as each of us were telling our stories, three other men in that one meeting had all lost their wives to breast cancer at a similar age within the last 6 months. And so as I'm listening to them tell their story, all I could think of was, yes, I went through that. Yes, I experienced that. Yeah, that happened too. And it immediately made me feel more comfortable that this is a place where I'm actually going to be around people that can relate to what I'm going through. You know, earlier you mentioned about how people will say, I feel sorry, I'm sad that this happened to you, I know how you feel. Quite honestly, unless you've actually been through it yourself, nobody can tell you how they feel. Nobody can say, I feel what you feel. But in that room, everybody was going through the same thing that I was going through.
Just out of curiosity, Bob, what about siblings? I mean, I'm wondering, did your son feel the same way as your youngest daughter felt or your oldest, or did they talk at all to each other about how they felt?
Absolutely. They all felt differently. They all had different emotions, different experiences as they were going through the grieving process. In the actual sessions that the center facilitates, siblings are never in the same room, so that it allows them to express emotions that they may even be having toward another sibling. My children would periodically talk about things at home, and in fact, I would try to engage them in conversation on the drive home from the sessions. But the reality is that most of the time, the kids don't want to tell their parents what they're feeling. My kids were worried enough about what I was going through. And a common emotion that the kids experience is that they don't want to make things worse for their parent, the surviving parent in my case. My kids didn't – they knew I was already sad about losing my wife. They didn't want me to feel more sad than I already did. And they were concerned that if I saw them crying, it might make me cry. And they didn't want that. They were concerned about me and how I was doing. So I think it's very common that the kids don't talk a lot with their parents. They may talk amongst themselves, but not as much with their parents, especially the older they get, because they're just concerned about making things worse.
Let me ask you about this, and I'm not sure if you talked about this in any of your counseling sessions or meetings, but there are people sometimes when they lose a loved one, they don't want to change anything. If they lose a wife, they want to leave the room exactly as it was. They don't want to throw anything of hers away. Or if a son dies, they want to leave the room exactly as it was. Is that healthy? or did they talk about that at all?
Once again, this falls into the category of everybody deals with grief differently,
uh-huh.
and you have to do it in your timing. I went through it in phases. It took me probably 6 months before I started to put any pictures away or before I started to clear some of her things out of our bedroom or out of our bathroom. It was realistically over a year before I could put her clothes into bags to get them ready to donate. And each of those stages is a very emotional event because it's just driving the point home that she's not coming back. But everybody has to do it at their own pace. And it's not something one of the things I learned through the process was never to judge the rate at which somebody else was going through the grieving process because it's so individual. It's so specific to the person that you can't say, well, you're doing this too soon or you're doing that too soon or why are you still doing that? Everybody has to deal with it differently.
Getting back to the men and we try and do things our own way, sometimes men will stay away from certain services because it may have a spiritual aspect to it. Even if it's interdenominational, they'll stay away from it because they'll say, I don't need any spiritual help to deal with this. I can deal with this by myself. Or they'll say if there is a God or if there is a higher being, then why did this happen to me? They deal with the anger.
Sure. The organization is secular in nature. There is no faith element officially to it. That doesn't mean that discussions about faith don't come up among the adults or even the children that are going through the counseling at the center. But as from a facilitation standpoint, there is no push in that direction. They won't stop that kind of discussion from happening if that's where the people want to take it. But there's no faith-based aspect to that. And so it opens it up to everybody, basically, and it doesn't limit it.
And as far as you attending the sessions, is it pretty much up to you when you want to stop going?
Absolutely. There are some people that will only go for a few sessions, and they'll feel like either they've gotten enough out of it or they really don't feel like it's helping or the kids don't want to go. And quite honestly, a lot of families stop going because the kids don't want to go. And I'll go back to the point that I made earlier, which is sometimes as parents, we need to do things and force our kids to do things whether they like it or not because we know it's the right thing for them. But a lot of parents have a hard time dealing with that because they're already struggling. And so as a parent dealing with a child who's lost a parent or a sibling, it's really hard to tell them, to make them do things they don't want to do because you don't want to make their life more difficult. But we still have to at times. But there's families that will only go a few times. And conversely, I mean, I ended up going for a year and a half. Now, all of my kids didn't go for the same length of time, but it was a year and a half after we started going that I stopped taking my youngest daughter. And there were people that were still going after, a better part of 2 years.
I'm sure also that at some point, whether it be 2 years from now, 5 years from now, and I know you have a daughter who's married already, but they may come up and say, Dad, Daddy, tell me a little bit about Mom. What was she like? I don't remember much.
My kids were a little bit older. I mean, my kids range from 10 to 16 when their mom died. So there's not as much of an issue of memory, loss of memory of her. However, we still have pictures of her up around the house. We still watch home videos from time to time, not on a regular basis, but from time to time, we do watch home videos that she's part of. And we'll laugh at the things that are going on in there. We've reached the point that while we're sad, certainly still, that she's not with us, and it can still be an emotional moment from time to time, we realize that what's happened has happened. We have moved on with our lives. And it's okay to go back and look at videos or pictures and talk about her in a loving way, in a memorable way, where you focus on the good things that happened and the fun times rather than dwelling on the fact that she's no longer with us.
Speaking about that, do they talk to you at all about, because this sometimes will not come as a guilt from the person themselves, but perhaps from friends, loved ones, and that's when one of, like you get married or the lady gets married. And some people are quick to judge, saying, you got married too soon, or I can't believe you got married. And again, as you mentioned earlier, everybody has a different way of grieving, and you have to move on.
Certainly, there is that aspect. I have remarried, and I know there are people that maybe felt that I married a little bit too soon. Realistically, I think even one or more of my children maybe felt the same way. We do talk about that in the sessions. We talk about when is it appropriate to start another relationship. And the reality is it all depends on how quickly or at the rate at which you go through the grieving process. If you're still dealing with significant grief and significant emotions to the point where it dominates your life, then that's the wrong time to consider starting another relationship because you're not being fair to yourself or the other person. So that kind of discussion does come up. But ultimately, it still becomes a function of what is the rate at which you go through the grieving process? When are you ready to move on? Quite honestly, I wasn't expecting it. In fact, I can remember having told people in a session maybe 2 weeks before I decided to ask this lady out that I still didn't see myself being ready. But it happened to be the right woman at the right time, and I was able to move on.
And then sometimes you have the issue, I'm sure, where the children feel betrayed.
Sure. And that is something that during the sessions, the counseling sessions, they do talk to the kids about it. When do you know, they'll ask the kids, when do you think it's appropriate or when are you ready for your mom or your dad to maybe start dating again? Are you ready now? If not, why not? What is it that will make you ready? So they do help the kids also try to prepare for it. Not that they're trying to force it on them, but at some point, you do have to move on. And so they do try to help the kids prepare for that moment.
Now, Bob, if someone is listening right now and perhaps they've recently lost a loved one and they want to take advantage of these services, what do they need to do?
The starting point would be to call the Children's Grief Center of El Paso. The number is 532-6004 and set up an initial interview to find out if they qualify. And by qualify, I mean, are their children the right age? We don't take children under the age of 5 just because it's really difficult for them to focus long enough to even make it through a session like that. Laura Olage, the executive director, likes to meet with the family ahead of time to make sure that they're really ready and prepared for the counseling. We do offer services in both Spanish and English. So that's one of the ways that we're able to help not only our community on this side of the border, but the community on the other side that's dealing with all the violence over there. Or if they want to stop by and just take a look at the facility, we're located at 11625B Pelicano, just east of George Dieter.
Do they need to make reservations in advance to
preferably
come by?
To go pay a visit. We would like them to call just to set up a time to come over there to make sure somebody will be available to spend the time with them. Again, the number is 532-6004.
And generally, how long will a session last once they get started?
Once they get started, the sessions start at 6:30 on Thursday evenings, and each group meets twice a month. So we have a group that meets the first and third Thursdays of the month and another group that meets the second and fourth Thursdays. And so the sessions start at 6:30 and they go till about 8 o'clock. So it's about an hour and a half once every other week.
And when you're talking about the sessions, do the parents and the children go at the same time?
They go at the same time, but they're separated. Yes. The parents all meet together with Laura facilitating, and then the children are broken into age-appropriate groups with other volunteer facilitators.
Now, as far as the information goes, you've given us a lot of information here, and if people didn't get it all, do you all have a website or a newsletter that you all put out?
We do. The website is www.cgcelpaso.org, and we do have information there about the services that are provided, as well as contact information. And if somebody decides that just, you know, they don't have a need for the service themselves, but they'd like to make a donation to the organization, they can even donate through our website.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for taking time to be with us. We've been visiting with Bob Mihalov, and he is on the board of directors of Children Grief Center of El Paso. If you are interested in finding out more about what the center does, you can call 532-6004. They are located at 11625B Pelicano. And if you want information on the web to find out more about them, you can go to cgcelpaso.org.
This segment of Perspectives originally aired in April of 2011, and the center was in the midst of celebrating its 15th anniversary at the time. Now approaching its 18th year, the Children's Grief Center is relevant to all families who need help in grief counseling. The information and this archive are available on our website, ktep.org. Click on the Listen button and search for Perspectives and this episode on children's grief. Up next, a mini travelogue to the newly incorporated city of San Elizario. The feature is part of the series The Shape of Texas from South Texas Public Broadcasting.
This is The Shape of Texas. The historic Far West Texas town of San Elizario dates to 1598, when a Spanish nobleman, Don Juan de Oñate, arrived to establish the province of New Mexico. His entourage included some 500 tired, thirsty travelers who drank the cool waters of the Rio Grande and celebrated what's considered the first Thanksgiving Mass in the present-day United States. Then they moved on. San Elizario was named for Saint Elzéar, the French patron saint of the military. A chapel bearing that name was built inside a presidio, or fort, in 1752. In 1789, the presidio and chapel were moved 37 miles to the west to protect travelers and settlers along the Camino Real, or Royal Highway, from Indian raids. When Rio Grande floodwaters damaged the chapel in 1877, it was reconstructed from new adobe bricks and also bricks from the original fort's walls. The present chapel may be the fourth on or near this site that served the garrison and the San Elizario community. It stands on an elevated platform and anchors the adjacent plaza. Robust buttresses support the chapel's massive adobe walls. Above the main entrance, there's a curvilinear belfry. The church is square, with three aisles and three apses behind the altar. Inside and outside, gleaming, whitewashed plaster walls capture the intense light. A fire destroyed the chapel's interior in 1935. Restoration was completed a decade later. Original wood beams are covered by a pressed tin ceiling. Painted white with light blue, gold, and lilac decorations, it disseminates light that streams through 10 stained glass windows. The windows depict flowers, representations of Spanish swords, and religious symbols. Slender, square neoclassical columns painted white with gold trim support arches and separate the main nave from the side aisles. Restoration of San Elizario's exterior began in 1990 and continues, funded by parishioners and community organizations. Though the chapel never was a mission, it's part of El Paso's Mission Trail, and a strong example of mission-style adobe architecture. For The Shape of Texas, produced for South Texas Public Broadcasting, I'm Bill Clough. Funding is provided by Texas Architect Magazine and the Texas Society of Architects at texasarchitect.org.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.